I didn't intend to share what I'm about to share with you, but I picked it up in my office from yesterday's mail just before I walked in. And it has to do with the general theme that I'm talking about for a few weeks. In this particular case, the peril, the great danger of having a kind of fierce certainty about religion. Here's a little story that illustrates that danger. Doesn't have to do with religion, but it transfers. The two sons of a Fort Worth, Texas woman of 90 were worried about her safety. "We're going to get you a pistol, mother, so you can take care of yourself. We're going to teach you how to use it, too. There's too much violence out there." So they bought their mother a pistol, which she dutifully packed in her purse. One day when she left Ridgemar Shopping Center to get into her car, she found two young men sitting in the car. She took out the pistol, pointed it at them, and said, "Get out of my car or I'll shoot." They jumped out and ran off. She got into the car, put the key in the ignition, and it did not fit. There are a couple of other lines, but they're anticlimactic, so forget about them. A very fine woman in this church, whose name you will not guess and whose name I would never reveal, called me one day a while back and said she was so upset with what some people do in the name of religion that she was about ready to drop her membership and stop going to church. "I'm ashamed to tell people I'm a Christian," she said, "when I read in the papers about this particular case," she said, "somebody trying to kill a doctor on the grounds that they are doing the will of God." An attorney comes back from a world tour and sums up his experiences. "I have returned convinced that in every nation, the major problems are theological. They stem from bad religion." He sees India trying to overcome famine and disease when its principal religion praises the ritual of bathing in the sacred Ganges, a river whose waters are murky with human excrement and the remains of the dead. He sees Tibetan Buddhists spinning prayer wheels to make their prayers more effective. He sees Catholicism in the poorest nations of the world, reinforcing by its theology the population explosion that endangers the world. He sees American Protestants defending segregation, preaching male chauvinism, consigning people to hell whose sexual orientation is different from the majority. "Bad religion," he says, "underlies many of the most horrendous evils on earth." Bad religion. Should we confess in church that there is such a thing? I mean not just confess it in general, but face up to the embarrassing specifics? I think we have to, if we're going to have any credibility at all with intelligent people. And at times in this series of sermons, but particularly this morning, I intend to do that. There's an old folk saying that the sweetest fruit rots the worst. And that idea that the better a thing is, the worse it is when it goes bad, underlies that old religious myth of a great archangel who revolted from God and became the devil. The higher a thing is, the lower it can fall. I can give you an analogy from another sphere. Patriotism, at its best, can mean something noble, an intelligent and sensitive love of one's country. Or it can be corrupted into what old Dr. Samuel Johnson called it in the 18th century, the last refuge of a scoundrel. Religion has that same dualism. It has brought benefits into the world so priceless that no one can estimate their full worth. In the name of religion, a Schweitzer goes to Lambaréné, a Kagawa goes to the slums of Tokyo, a Father Damien to the leper colony at Molokai, a Mother Teresa to the filthy streets of Calcutta, and that's just a start in the long list of great human beings moved by their devotion to Christ to care. I could spend 6 months telling you about nameless nuns, medical missionaries, unsung heroes of faith who reflect honor on religion all around the world. But let's face it, corrupted, there is nothing much worse. I told you last week about the Crusades, one long, shuddering chapter in the history of cruelties committed in the name of religion. We are tempted sometimes to divide people into two groups, the religious and the so-called irreligious, and to assume that being religious confers some superior quality on people. But the founder of our religion knew better than that. Before certain religious people killed him in the name of their faith, he said perceptively to some of them, "If the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" I became fascinated by that paradox last week as this sermon took shape. If the light that is in you is darkness, then that darkness is even blacker than usual. He isn't talking about literal day and night. This is a poet at work, not a scientist. What he means is that if your religion is misinformed or malicious, it can be worse for you and others than no religion at all. What he meant, and what he might just as truly have said, is that religion is as ambiguous as electricity. It can warm you and cook your meals, electricity can, or it can blast and kill you. As ambiguous as water, it can clean you up, slake your thirst, or it can flood your home and drown you. No one understood better than he did that any powerful force for good is capable of equal harm. Look back through history a long time, and there stands on a certain street one day a man named Saul of Tarsus, holding the clothes of Stephen, the first Christian martyr, while a crowd of Saul's fellow religionists stone him to death. What motivated that cruelty? Religion. Watch this same Saul, headed to the city of Damascus, breathing threats and murder against the Christians there. What drives him? His religion. Now see him years later, transformed, and writing the incomparable lyric on love that ends, "So faith, hope, and love abide, and the greatest of these is love." What inspires him now? His religion. But a religion as different from his early faith as night from day. Over a generation ago, a professor at City College of New York, a man named Morris Cohen, wrote an essay. Must have been reprinted in 100 different college anthologies, called "The Dark Side of Religion." It's painful to read if you love the kinds of things we stand for in this place, as I do, but we are no more than simplistic propagandists unless we face up to that dark side. Cohen reminds us that the religious instinct may lead us to mercy or to meanness, to beauty or bestiality. It may burn old women as witches, as some of our congregational forebears did, whip them half naked through the streets of Boston, or torture heretics to death whose only sin was that they tried to think for themselves. Cohen reminds us how the church, given far too often to superstition and magic and witchcraft, has hindered the progress of physics, chemistry, medicine by persecuting pioneer scientists. He reminds us how horrible the Inquisition was and those holy wars of history, and how our own contemporary, the Reverend Pat Robertson, claims that he prayed a hurricane off course, how a lovely psalm in Hebrew scripture starts out so beautifully, "By the waters of Babylon we sat down and wept. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion, only to end up saying with horrific bitterness, happy shall be anybody who takes the babies of our enemies and bashes their heads against a rock." Sacred prostitution, human sacrifice, child sacrifice, what a list. We simply cannot deny that some of the most heinous evils in the world have come from people who knew absolutely that God was on their side. In the three most intransigent situations in our world today, Ireland, the Middle East, parts of Africa, religion plays a critical role in each one. That cute little church sign slogan that says, "Things go better with God," might seem almost blasphemous to some people in Belfast or Beirut or Cape Town. Part of the problem is suggested in this brief exchange of dialogue between the angel Gabriel and Satan in the work of some anonymous author. Gabriel says to Satan about evil, "We will defeat you since we shall fill the minds and hearts of our people with the highest ideals." To which Satan responds, "Ah, yes, but I will win in the end, for I shall institutionalize all your ideals." Organized religion can do hideous things which single persons would not dream of doing on their own except for what the organization taught them. Case in point, I have in my files a story out of Henderson, Texas, about a man named Dax, D-A-X, an odd first name, Dax Cowart, who was so horribly burned many years ago that he begged the first man who approached him to give him a gun so he could kill himself. For over a year, nurses dipped him daily in a tank of Clorox solution and scrubbed his burned skin while he screamed, "Please, please let me die." Then they took him back to bed, where he screamed until he was exhausted enough to pass out. Both hands had to be amputated. Both eyes had to be removed, the latter a kind of perverse blessing, since it kept him from seeing how people shuddered at the sight of his face. His days since have been spent affirming the right of any sane adult to choose death under circumstances as unbearable as he thought his to be. A documentary of his case was a runner-up in the 1985 American Film Festival, and a book about his treatment was written by a Southern Methodist University professor of religious studies who called it Dax's Case, Essays in Medical Ethics and Human Meaning. At the time of my article, 16 years after Dax was burned, he was still insisting that he should have had the right to die. But I'm not discussing this morning the right to die. All of this is only by way of preface, so you will understand what I tell you next about what religion of a certain kind can do to the soul. Dax's mother refused to help him find a lawyer who might file a restraining order against the hospital, which insisted he be kept alive. No matter how much he wished to die, she was opposed, and I can understand that reaction from a mother. But listen to another and perhaps even more compelling reason why she couldn't let him die. Her son had rejected her fundamentalist church's teachings long before his accident, and she was fearful that if he died, his unsaved soul would go to hell. The way I thought about it, she said, was that what he was going through was just a sample of what eternal damnation would be. Her religion put even a son in hell for changing to a different church. You know, it is absolutely not true that any religion is better than none. I've heard parents say that. The idea either dismays me or infuriates me. I have seen bad religion in one personal encounter after another. I know what a destructive force it can be. I've forgotten 100 other cases, like that of the young woman who came into my office one day explaining hysterically that if she stayed in the religion in which she'd been brought up, it would drive her mad. But that if she left it, and she meant this, it would quite literally destroy her sick but incredibly narrow-minded father. She was a mess. Religion, the wrong kind of religion, had ruined her life. I was sitting in my church office in St. Louis late one afternoon when a man almost scared me out of my wits by appearing soundlessly in the open door when I was the only one there on a dark evening. His eyes were wild. His lips trembled. He had been wandering on the streets and had thrown his wallet into a storm sewer, hoping to placate the tormenting god of his religion. Somehow he thought if he could be a child again, that innocence might please God. So he begged me to take him back and let him see the nursery. And when he looked at the toys, He cried uncontrollably. And then he stood in front of me like a man ready to do away with himself. And he said, Will you please call me your brother? His fundamentalist church had told him that he was not good enough. And so he wanted me to call him my brother in faith, wanted me to be a fellow believer who was willing to accept him as he was. What was the matter with him? Religion. Bad religion. It had destroyed his marriage, his home, and it was on the verge of destroying him. I was the editor once for a couple of years of a daily newspaper. I remember talking to the woman who drowned her little boy because she thought he was naughty, and that because of his naughtiness, God wanted the child to die. She was a very religious woman. I was beginning to realize in those days how cruel and ignorant some religious faith can be, and how terrifying it is that people like that woman can become so positive they know what God wants. I mentioned to you once how certain religious men, emphasis on men, were sure they knew the will of God about women in childbirth. When Sir James Simpson discovered chloroform as an anesthetic and said how humanely helpful it could be in cases of childbirth, these men were so certain of God's mind that they said chloroform was undoubtedly, and I'm quoting it directly, a decoy of Satan, apparently opening itself to bless women, but in the end hardening them and robbing God of the deep, earnest cries that should arise to him in times of trouble. Now you shake your head in astounded disbelief. How could anyone have ever said such a thing? How could it have been said in the name of religion? Well, the answer may not come, but the question has to be raised, or we have no way of being safe from the dark side of religion. To that wonderful lady who was so embarrassed about it that at the moment she wanted to give up church, I can only say that I share the embarrassment. And I am willing to say publicly how bad religion can be, but I also believe profoundly in good religion. And I am glad to be in the company of people who are more generous and compassionate than they would be without it. My own role worries me a little, that of a religious professional, which I think is one of the most dangerous things in the world. And I'm embarrassed by Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and Oral Roberts and Robert Tilton, but I do not let myself forget that behind these men and behind the sensational stories that make good headlines, there are quite literally thousands of ministers all over America who visit the sick, comfort the bereaved, rejoice at weddings, weep at funerals, do quietly all the dull and mundane things any minister does to keep a church going, good and decent people who make life better than it would be without them. And I say to myself, if I can be worthy of them, I shall not be fatally embarrassed by the others.